Lord Jesus, we have just prayed together in the words of that hymn, all your good pleasure in our lives fulfill. And so often we are blind and we are deaf to the marvelous wonders of your grace and the great depth and breadth and height and length of your love. And so we close our hearts to you. And like foolish, wayward sheep, we go our own way. We ask now that as we look into your word, that you will come by your Spirit and enable us to hear your voice, and grant that we may discern something of your mighty grace and what you would do in us and for us and through us, for our happiness and fulfillment and for your glory. Amen. I was once asked to speak to university students on the subject of coping with failure. I found it very difficult to prepare an address on that subject, because not only did it involve looking into God's Word to see how different men and women had failed and had coped in their failure, but much harder than that, it also involved looking into my own heart and life, and admitting that there were many failures littering my own years and my own attempts. And I'm sure that failure is something that we all dread. The prospect of failure can haunt us. Failing at our job, maybe failing exams, failing in our marriage, failing with our children, failing as a son or a daughter, failing as a friend. Maybe a number of us in church this evening need to think a little bit about coping with failure. Maybe recently, for some reason or another, someone here has felt a failure. And to feel like that can have a very deep effect on one's living. We can become withdrawn and lonely. Or we can pretend we don't really care, when all the time we care very much. Or we can stop trying and we can opt for something less when we ought to be aiming for something more. Failure affects us in different ways. Some people even need to visit their doctor, and they need to go on medication because they have such a profound sense of their own failure. And they cease to be able to function as people because they're overwhelmed by this awful sense of being a failure. Well, it may be that this evening some realize that they're failures as Christians. You've resolved to fight against some sin, some weakness, some flaw in your character. But after praying about it and fighting it, you've gone and fallen again. You really did ask God for his help. You really did want God to help you. But when the crunch came, down you went. And you found yourself flat on your face in the mud, a failure. So even as a Christian, you feel a failure. I want to say one or two simple things. First, God knows all about our failures. And wonder of wonders, he still loves us and he still wants us. No, God doesn't go off us when we make a mess of following his Son. In fact, it was while we were at our worst that he loved us and gave his Son for us. The love of God and the love of Jesus, and of course the two are one, they're like a great anchorage. And no furious waves of failure can ever shift them or dislodge them. And at our very worst, the Lord loves us more than we ever dream. But then I want to say this as well, that failure and guilt and the mess we make of following Christ all make no difference to God's great purpose for us. And that purpose is that ultimately we should change and become triumphant, mature, able Christian men and women. When young men are learning to fly, or I suppose nowadays young women as well, with the RAF, If they don't get up into the air solo after so many hours training, then they are rejected. They are too slow in their learning. I'm glad to be able to tell you that that's not how God works. He doesn't take weeks over us putting up with our failures and our mistakes. He doesn't take years with us. He takes our whole lifetime. So that long after your doctor or your psychiatrist or your friend or your pastor or your counselor or even your husband or your wife, long after these have given you up as a bad job, God is still willing to wait and to work in order to produce in us that mature fruit of Christian character that we so lack and that by the grace of His Spirit we long for. Well, here's something for the greatest encouragement of us all this evening. After a whole long life of making the most terrible mess, trying to change but never succeeding, after 130 odd years of failure, at long, long last we find ancient old Jacob a different man. Yes, though it took God over 100 years, God was willing to wait all that time to make Jacob into the kind of man that God planned that he should be. And if the Lord was willing to do that for Jacob, I can assure you, He's willing to do it for all of us. First this evening, will you notice how in Jacob's life there are now new fears? He'd always been a frightened kind of a guy. Frightened that his brother would be more powerful, more wealthy than he. Frightened then that his brother would take his revenge and kill him. And then frightened that his uncle Laban would refuse to let him go. And then frightened of the meeting that had to come with Esau. And then frightened that Esau would change his mind and take his revenge after all. And then frightened that the same would happen to Benjamin as it happened to Joseph. A man just full of fears, a pessimist, always seeing the worst round the corner, afraid of this and afraid of that. And now we find that all these human fears that have so enslaved him and so hedged him in and so controlled his actions and his life in the past, we find that they are replaced by altogether new fears. Fears which are right and proper and godly. Let me explain how I reach that. The old man has heard the news. Joseph is alive and lord of all Egypt. And Joseph has sent wagons and supplies for his father to make the journey to Egypt, there to stay and there to be cared for as long as the famine lasts. And so Jacob has packed his belongings, and the whole family, 70 men and women and children, with herds and flocks, are slowly making their way to Egypt. And they pitch camp at Beersheba, which is the very last outpost in southern Canaan. And there they camp for the night, preparing to cross the Sinai Desert, that grueling, punishing journey on their way into Egypt. But Beersheba is a place full of memories for Jacob. He knows only too well. It was here that his grandfather, Abraham, had gone wrong when he went into Egypt, and he shouldn't have gone there. And Sarah, Abram's wife's honor, was nearly ruined, and God's purposes nearly wrecked. And it was here that his own father Isaac had gone wrong in his leaving Canaan and becoming involved with Abimelech. And it was here that he was now going to take the step and cross the border and leave the promised land of Canaan behind. The land that God had promised to Abraham and to Isaac and to him and to their descendants. Was he doing the right thing? Or was he falling into a trap and leaving his God behind as well? Long after the others were all asleep, we find aged Jacob awake and in prayer. For the first time in his life, he's afraid that he might be disobeying God and neglecting God's will. Wonder if you know that verse from Proverbs. I'm sure you do. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. At last Jacob has learned this wisdom. He's learned to fear God, to be afraid lest he should forsake and leave the pathway that God has planned for him. I wonder if any of us suffer from fears. I don't mean the childish kind of fear, such as fear of the dark or frightened of spiders. I mean adult fears. Fears of the future and what the future might hold for us. Fears that we maybe might be left without any money. Fears that we might lose our friends. Fears that we might lose our reputation. What do other people think about us? What do the neighbors think? These are fears that people have about all kinds of things. Fears about work, fears about next week, fears about the family, fears about the children. This past week I sat in someone's home and I spoke with a woman and her sister for about an hour, and she admitted her whole life was lived in fear. Didn't take a psychiatrist to see fear written all over her face. It was actually becoming pathological. And some people do end up in hospital as the result of fears. We call them phobias. But they're really just fears which obsess them and take over their thinking to such an extent that they cease to be able to function normally and live normal lives. So obsessed and taken over and overwhelmed are they by their fears. Now, I'm not suggesting that anyone in church is as afraid as that. But what I do want to point out is that the Bible teaches us that without God, we're bound to live in fear. God came to his servant Isaiah and spoke to him very directly about this subject of fear. And the word that came to him was that he mustn't have the kind of fears that the rest of society had. They were worried about war breaking out, about losing their homes and their livelihoods, about being carried away to concentration camps. God spoke to Isaiah and he said, don't fear what they fear. Don't dread what they dread. The Lord Almighty is the one you are to regard as holy. He is the one you are to fear. He is the one you are to dread. You see, when our hope is in God, and when the Lord is our God, all these things that the world fear, they somehow become irrelevant and faint. And we realize that our lives and our times and our future and our jobs and our destiny, everything is in God's great hands. And so the fears the rest of the world has, they are pointless. Instead, we have another fear. We fear God with a holy, filial fear. A filial fear means the respect and the reverence that a son has for a father. And that means we're afraid to grieve God. We're afraid lest we should disobey him. Remember Joseph and Potiphar's wife? When Joseph was tempted, what did he say? How can I do this great sin against God? Joseph feared to step outside God's law, outside God's loving protection. And that is the great fear of the believer. The believer dreads more than anything else wandering away from his Lord. And this is the lesson old Jacob has learned. And so he trembles at the prospect of traveling to Egypt, lest he should be stepping out of God's will for his life. And God comes to the old man and says, Jacob, don't be afraid. You're on the right road. This is my will for you. Keep right on with your journey. I am with you. Oh, that our lives could always be controlled and governed by fear of God. For the fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom, and Jacob has learned after all these years that fear. In his life, new fears. But then also notice about Jacob now, his faith. There was something that this man had been running away from for years, but somehow it had always managed to catch up with him. Wonder if you can guess what it was. It was his cheating nature. Jacob, the supplanter. Perhaps when he ran away from Esau as a young man, he thought he'd left his old nature behind. But he hadn't. It followed him right to his uncle's. Perhaps when he ran away from his uncle's, he thought once again he'd left it behind. But no, when he left Esau after his meeting with him, it followed him again, do you remember? Over the years, how he'd fought against that wretched, devious nature of his, always wanting to place the pawns and the people on the chessboard just so that he could get his way. Just when he thought he'd overcome it, its ugly head came up again. Even though God had given him a new name at Peniel, the name Israel, which means Prince of God, we find him still called Jacob, because he'd never managed to shake off the old Jacob in himself. For years of Jacob's life, he'd had two names. I wonder if you noticed right through the passage that we read this evening, the two names were used interchangeably. They were twined together. And my understanding of his two names, Jacob and Israel, is that they reflected his two natures. The old nature of the cheat and the new nature that God was working patiently and lovingly to form in him. And it's the principle that we find in our New Testament in Romans chapter 6, Romans chapter 7, Galatians chapter 5, a struggle going on. The old nature or the flesh and the spirit or the new nature. And I think that if we don't know anything of that struggle, that tussle going on between our old nature and the new nature, if we don't know anything about that, then we don't know anything about being a Christian. But what has happened to the old man that he should be any different now? Well, for 15, 16, 17 years, quite how long, we're not absolutely sure, but certainly for long, long years, he's mourned and grieved the death of his dearest son, Joseph. And there was a sense, if I'm not reading too much into it, in which Jacob himself had died in his sorrow. His natural way of getting out of trouble in the past had been to pull a fast one, to outsmart the other, to outwit them, and so to come out himself on top. But he couldn't do that in this sorrow. To him, Joseph had died. And with Joseph's death had come another death, the death of the old way of doing. His proud independence, his self-sufficiency, his ingenuity, his cleverness. It's all drained away, and he's been left broken and limp and all but crushed. And there's only one thing he can do, and that is to cling by his fingernails to God and his promises. He's bowed his neck to the severe discipline of his life, and he's learned to accept the will of God. And now at last, from that death, there is coming a resurrection. For the son who was lost has been found. The son who was dead is alive again. Did you notice that Jacob's spirit revived? It resurrected. And he begins the last chapter of his life. And it's the most wonderful chapter of all. I wonder if you remember, either from your childhood or from your youth, or maybe from your womanhood and manhood if you're old enough, or if you're not old enough from your history class, I wonder if you remember that after the last war, General de Gaulle was rejected by France. They didn't want to know him, and so he retired to the country and a quiet life. But then years later, when he'd almost been forgotten, France was plunged into deep trouble in the struggle in Algeria, and she was leaderless and divided. And as the nation was almost on her knees, the cry was taken up, "Bring back Charles de Gaulle." And he came back. And he was able in his own way to restore to France her dignity and even her greatness as a nation. I wonder if we know that God sometimes retires from our lives to wait his time. He waits until we've learned to die to our old way of doing things. He waits until we're at last willing to let him lead us and direct us. And we dither and we hesitate and we limp between two opinions, and God waits. But he's not inactive. In his sovereignty and in his providence, he's ordering our lives and events and our relationships, until at last we've learned to die to ourselves, until at last we're humble enough and broken enough and willing enough to listen to him and at last to obey. I love the little picture that we're given of God speaking to old Jacob in the night while the others are all asleep. He said his prayers, and then they've gone to bed. He sacrificed and called on God. And then in the stillness and silence and darkness of the night, God comes to him and opens his heart and reveals himself, and Jacob's faith surges with a new life. And you know, I am utterly convinced that the next morning, his sons and his daughters-in-law and his grandchildren and the whole company can see a change in the old man. They can see it in his face and his bearing. There is a confidence. There is a poise. There is a new strength, a new calm, a serenity, a determination. His faith has been renewed and is again anchored in his God. I wonder how it is with us this evening. Oh, my friends, let's not deceive ourselves. We have problems, don't we? We have burdens, we have fears. How is life treating you? You didn't think God had forgotten about you, did you? He's waiting until we're ready, wholly, to trust him. But I think there must have been something beautifully simple and childlike about this old man's new faith in God. So simple and so childlike, maybe too simple and too childlike for some of us here, that it was purer and clearer and truer and more lovely to see than anything he'd ever known before. And with his hand in God's hand, like a wee boy of 2 or 3 or 4 walking along the road with his hand in his father's strong big hand, old Jacob continues that harrowing journey across the Sinai desert, knowing that the Father is with him. And then finally, this evening, after fear, new fears, and faith, new faith, notice very briefly the fulfillment in Jacob's life. He met Joseph and they embraced, and for a long, long time, and we can understand this, can't we? They wept. And then his words were, "Now let me die. I've seen your face, and you're still alive." And you know, that wasn't a morbid thing to say. He was obviously expressing the very deepest peace, and he was saying, "I'm now ready. Whenever the time shall come, my soul is at peace with my God. All is well." In fact, he lived many more years. He lived to make some of the greatest prophecies in the whole Bible. God willing, over this autumn, we will look into them in some detail. And he lived to testify to Pharaoh of God's faithfulness to him. And I think this last chapter in his life, as I said a moment ago, was the very happiest chapter, because he knew of the great purpose of God and the promise of God, and he knew that they were true and steadfast, and that God could be trusted and would never, never let him down. Sometimes we hear of awful floods that come and sweep over a country like Bangladesh, a tidal wave that brings destruction and destitution. Can I say to you, my friends, that God's purposes are never a tidal wave? They are worked by a master hand that takes into account all our weaknesses and all our failures. And God's purposes weave into our lives that golden thread that leads to ultimate fulfillment. And so the promise of God to those who fear him and who have faith in him is the promise of fulfillment. What is that fulfillment? It's a change, it's a metamorphosis, a transformation. It's a change from being what we hate to be, a change from being failures, forever falling short of his glory, forever putting our two big feet straight into it, forever making a mess and such a tangle of following Jesus Christ. The fulfillment is a change to becoming like Jesus and showing in our lives the fruit of a Christ-like nature. Perhaps you say, do you know, I can't see it coming in my life. If only I could. I can't see it. And I say, God will wait for years, even for a lifetime, until at last he changes us into what he not only wants us to be, but created us to be, reflecting the image and his glory and the glory of his Son. Jacob's life in one way was a sad life, wasn't it? He had so many troubles, so many struggles. And I suppose that makes the joy and the triumph of his final years in this last chapter of his story so much the more glorious and wonderful. But while it's truly remarkable that God should be so patient and so persistent and so resolved to change him, I wonder if I'm going too far when I hazard the suggestion that it maybe was just a pity that it took so long. What I mean is this, I only hope and pray that God doesn't have to wait quite as long with me as he had to wait and was prepared to wait with Jacob. Not many of us, if any of us, will be called on to give our testimony to the most powerful man in the world as Jacob was going to be in a few days' time. I suppose God had to do a really thorough job in his life for such a testimony. But oh, that you and I might reflect the beauty and the likeness of Jesus much sooner. I honestly believe that the Lord can begin to shine out from our lives today, this evening, tomorrow morning, this next week. Isn't that what the Lord wants? Yes, his purpose is to change us. That's his plan. Well, I want to start cooperating with God's plan right now. Today, will you join me in praying that we'll be obedient as a people, soft and malleable clay in the potter's hands, so that he can shape us to be the kind of people he wants us to be for his glory.